My mother believed and my father believed that if I wanted to be president of the United States, I could be vice president. This is
America. Former Vice President Joe Biden has been elected president of the United States.
It is my greatest honor and privilege to have been your president. We will be back in some form.
We are still deeply divided.
Public health experts warned this was coming unless more was done. And here we are now.
Are you proud of what happened here today?
Absolutely.
Never before in American history has there been an uprising like this.
Of the 75 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump, I don't know how many today are feeling, dear God, what was I thinking? But I would wager a lot more are thinking, let's carry on this fight.
Character matters. It matters. Tell them the truth matters.
The 21st century is going to be the American century. Because we lead not only by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. That is the history of the journey of America.
It's the Irishman in America podcast from the Irishman Abroad podcast network with me, Jarlath Regan, over here, and Marion McKeown, as always, over there. Marion, it's a week of dog killings, college protests, Trump trials, and an awful lot more. But it's hard to know now, isn't it? What is the most significant story? What, in your opinion, should we be talking about? Because it feels like there's an awful lot of flashy stuff that's drawing the attention and filling the column inches when important things are actually happening.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good point. And we always have the shiny silver ball of Trump's antics in court and various other things. To me, at the moment, in terms of this week, and I say this having been to several of the college campuses where there is disturbances and where in UCLA last night it tipped over into violence, that in the prism of this whole situation, the awful violence, the war in Gaza, in the Middle East, the way that the Biden administration is being utterly hobbled by it, the fear that the DNC convention in August, when Biden is officially nominated by the party, is going to be a rerun of 1968 in Chicago, when we saw shock, well, we weren't around, but we read about and saw footage of shocking brutality against protesters by the police back then when they were protesting the Vietnam War.
So there's real fear that could be what happens.
Yeah, absolutely that. And it's already been said by the protesters that if this war is still ongoing, and honestly at this stage, there doesn't seem to be much hope that it won't be, that the DNC convention will be a focal point for protesters, that they will arrive in Chicago en masse. Now, you know, again, it's easy in theory to say this, and for the organizers, it's more complicated and more expensive to ship a lot of people to an expensive city and get them, you know, in one place. But it's also made easier now in ways with social media, that you can put up anything on Instagram. You can say, we're gathering here, you know, and 5 minutes later. I think it's an unknown quantity but there's real concern in the Biden administration that the images coming out of the DNC convention in August in Chicago will not be Biden being feted by all of the grandees in the Democratic Party and the usual scattering of celebrities and what have you, but that will be what's happening outside the event.
Well,
outside
wouldn't that the be forum. The most extraordinary turn of events, that all of this pressure internationally from other world leaders, that in fact it could be the students that force his hand to bring this to an end? Because I'm sure that that's not images that he wants to occur. He does not want that public image. Do you talk us through a little bit of what's taken place on these campuses and what you've seen firsthand?
Right. Well, this started quite some time ago. You may remember very shortly after the Hamas attack on Israeli civilians, which of course started the war, which was the inciting incident, if you will, for this brutal war. They college professors, Liz McGill and the president of Harvard, were called before Congress, and they were basically excoriated for largely political reasons, to some degree, that they hadn't done enough to stop protests on their campuses. Now, back then, the protests were nothing. They were so small and so scattered. And I think that the president of McGill, of Penn State University, Liz McGill in particular, was absolutely savaged by members of Congress for not having blocked a day of celebration of Palestinian culture. They had a festival of Palestinian writers and musicians that happened before the attacks. So people, you know, everybody had their dander up. They were getting really angry at any suggestion of any sympathy for any Palestinian cause whatsoever in the immediate aftermath of the attacks, which were really shocking. But since then, in the intervening 6 months, the Israel's persecution of the war in Gaza has been so brutal, has just broken so many international laws, has been so cynical, the targeting of refugee camps, the targeting of hospitals, schools, the absolute annihilation of Gaza. And this has caused sympathy to shift very much towards the plight of the Palestinian people, and in particular the civilians in Gaza and what they're suffering. And so this has, there's been a spate of protests on campuses, mainly in the Ivy League colleges initially. So you had Harvard, you had Yale, you had Columbia University, which is a ground zero at the moment, and then Stanford and several other colleges as well. And most recently, USC, the University of Southern California. Now, what's interesting is that so you have had Palestinian supporters of Palestine and people who are protesting Israel's prosecution of the war. Some of these are Jewish students. They're groups, Jewish Students for Peace, who have joined forces. But then increasingly there's been a pushback from pro-Israeli supporters, and they have been coming and saying this war is necessary and how dare you, and look what happened on October 7th. And it's becoming increasingly heated. Now, part of the problem is that the college authorities really have not handled this well at all. And, you know, it was seen in Columbia University in New York that the president of Columbia University's appearance, and this is a very experienced woman who was, she was at the London School of Economics. She worked at the World Bank. She's had a number of jobs where that required building consensus and dealing with people. It was felt that she really mishandled the situation, that she was determined not to lose her job as the presidents of Harvard and Penn State did. And so she went before Congress and she suggested that these protests were inherently anti-Semitic. And she also threw a number of staff under the bus, a number of faculty members. And she also revealed information about disciplinary procedures which were regarded as private business. You know, so in response to that, and in response to her calling the police and having 93 protesters arrested, the whole thing in Colombia mushroomed, and then it spread like wildfire across to the West Coast, where I am now. And I've been to the protests at the University of Southern California and UCLA. Now, interestingly, the University of Southern California, the reason that protest really got underway was every year these graduation ceremonies in America at these private colleges are huge events, and they, you know, they're so fancy and they spend so much money on them, and they're largely regarded as an ad that you know, they'll appear when they're soliciting donors, when they're soliciting new students. As I say, you know, at University of Southern California, USC, I think fees start at around $60,000 a year. It's extremely expensive to go to these colleges, and they want to kind of show parents, look, you're getting value for money, and donors as well. So what happened there was a decision was taken that they would no longer allow the valedictorian is regarded as the most brilliant student of the graduating year across all disciplines, and they are chosen to give an address. Now, in this case, it was a young woman. She's a Muslim woman from Southeast Asia. Her CV, her achievements, a biomedical engineering graduate, are just phenomenal. I mean, her grades were almost 100%. She'd done work in the community. She'd done a whole bunch of other stuff. She did a minor in genocides, and that was also part of her studies. And she was suddenly, before she'd even written her speech, disinvited basically from giving her speech by USC, by the board. She was told, no, sorry, you can't speak anymore for safety reasons. Well, what were the safety reasons? It wasn't made clear. And then it seemed that on her Instagram page, she had a link. She had linked to a pro-Palestinian group. And it seems that that was the reason that she was disinvited from giving her speech. So, of course, that triggered. And, you know, First Amendment rights and the cowardice of the college to do that, that they were afraid of rattling donors, or, and there was no indication what her speech was even going to be about. This understandably caused a furor. Now, moving, and there were protests there, and then the police were called in there, and it was really badly handled. Moving over to UCLA, it's been a feature that the public colleges versus the private colleges are much more relaxed about protests. They're much more relaxed about allowing students to exercise their First Amendment rights. So at UCLA, there wasn't really that much of a fuss. They said, okay, you know what, the pro-Palestinian groups set up camp. They've been setting up tents, and they sort of occupied the space outside what is the Powell Library and Royce Hall in UCLA, two beautiful buildings. And there's a green in the middle, which is usually where the graduation ceremony takes place because it's so beautiful. And I've got to say, the campus at UCLA, it's like a 500-acre country club. It is stunning. It's in the middle of Beverly Hills and Bel Air. And as public colleges go, it's pretty damn fancy. Mm. So there was a lot of tension when I was there between the students who were supporting Israel's war in Gaza and the students who were protesting it. And they were really screaming past each other, and temperatures and passions were running very, very high. Well, that all tipped into outright violence on Tuesday night, when it seems from the footage, and I don't want I've been looking at footage, and I spoke to the college spokespeople earlier, that it seems that the violence erupted from footage. It seems it started when a pro-Israeli person hit a pro-Palestinian supporter with a pretty large stick, and it just sort of erupted from there. They had private security guards, the police were called, and the whole thing just became really ugly. But, you know, you could almost see it coming. And I got to say, Jarla, the level of disinformation. Well, I spoke to a lot of the students at UCLA over the last couple of days on both sides. I spoke to pro-Palestinian students who said that basically October 7th was a hoax, that it didn't really happen, and that this was just a pretext for Israel to go and pound the bejesus out of Gaza. And then on the other side, I had claims from these pro-Israeli students that they had been maced and tasered and beaten up by pro-Palestinian students. I went to the college and I spoke to security guards, and they all said, no, we've had no reports of that. We haven't seen any evidence of that. I was also told that by the pro-Israeli students who were yelling this at the Palestinians, that Hamas had hung 70 gay teenagers in Gaza in the last week. You know, stuff like this, that there's no grounding. The currency of information, you would think, because with the internet and citizen journalism and the footage we're seeing coming out of Gaza, that there would be not so much capacity for disinformation. But it seems that the ubiquity of information has allowed so much bad information to infiltrate it. And it really seemed to me that so many of these students were protesting on the basis of fiction on both sides.
Wow. You know, isn't that something that, like, the way you break it down there, Marion, so interesting. Like you say, there's more access to news than ever before, but equally there's less and less reliable stuff. And everybody's got a counter argument to the argument you give, and evidence, empirical data, doesn't seem to matter, because even that's called into question. Now, I wanted to ask, because we're here in Ireland, we're seeing our own protests, and we're hearing the phone-in shows and the general consensus around the right of people to protest, the place of the protest, the imposition it's causing on others. What do you sense is the overall general sense among the wider American public of those engaging in these protests?
Oh, they're very anti the protesters in general. In general, they think that these are sort of little snotty-nosed entitled brats who are, and how dare they do this, and how dare they, and there's this is amongst, you know, the Republicans in particular have come down on the pro-Palestinian protesters like a ton of bricks. And you may, Mike Johnson went to Columbia last week to address the crowds, and well, nobody could hear a word he said anyway over the shout. But basically to say this is disgraceful and we stand with Israel. And there's also, and this always happens, there is, now I have no doubt that there is some anti-Semitism happening on these college campuses, because the slurs both sides were yelling at each other were pretty damn ugly from what I heard. You know, so absolutely, I think that there is, you know, there's some pretty ugly stuff happening on these campuses. But also there is a tendency in America, we've spoken about this before, Jarlath, to conflate any criticism of Israel, no matter how slight, no matter how timid, with outright anti-Semitism. And it's really a way of weaponizing sort of so many things and of controlling the dialogue. So there is a predisposition in America to believe that these protests are anti-Semitic, that these protests are all about intimidating Israeli students, about intimidating Jews, and about intimidating the whole Jewish community in general. Now, I have to say, having been on these campuses, I have no doubt there is hostility to Jewish people being displayed on these campuses. But I don't think that overall that is the main thrust of these protests. The main thrust of these protests, and from everybody I've spoken to, is they want to draw attention to what's happening in Gaza. They want to draw attention to the suffering in Gaza. And most importantly, the student demand is that they want their universities to divest. They want them to stop. All of these universities have endowments. Harvard has an endowment of $100 billion. They all invest their money in a bunch of companies, in military manufacturing companies, all this kind of thing. And the students are demanding that the colleges stop investing their endowments, stop investing their billions in companies that do business in Israel and in companies that make weapons for Israel. Now, realistically, that's never going to happen, because what happens in America, and it doesn't happen in Ireland so at all, is donors to big billionaire donors to colleges who will give Harvard 10 million, 50 million, 100 million, you know, an outright donation, are now saying that they're withdrawing their money. And a lot of them have already done it. Bob Kraft has said that he's pulling out of Columbia. So the trustees and the president, and what they want to keep the money. Now, there's no equivalent. To me, it's always been one of the most extraordinary things about the Jewish communities in America, their generosity to institutions of learning, to medical institutions, to the arts. You know, really, without the Jewish community in New York would be a pretty drab place. But it's all, what's also happening now is there is no counterweight on the other side. So there is no financial leverage that you know, the pro-Palestinian communities have, because the Muslim communities, because they don't fund, they don't donate in the same way. So obviously the Harvard presidents and the Ivy League presidents and boards are going where the money is. And it's they see it as a pragmatic business decision that they are not going to do things that will cause donors to leave in droves, particularly when they saw what happened at Harvard and at Penn State.
What about how the police are responding? I mean, their behaviour is always so heavy-handed in these situations, and it seems like nothing's been learned. Was there any discussion of this?
Right. Now, I will say that it depends on which police you're talking about. The way that the Hamilton Hall in Columbia University in New York was cleared by the police was really a masterclass in how police should behave in these situations. Okay. It was completely orderly. It was completely organized. Just to give context to the gang out there, on Monday and Tuesday this week, because of basically, the situation in Columbia escalated. A lot of people blamed the president of Columbia. A lot of people blamed the students. Now, what happened was that the encampments that were on the lawn in Columbia were basically abandoned, forcibly in some cases, and the students moved into Hamilton Hall. Now, there was a very clear intention by the students. Back in 1968, Hamilton Hall was occupied by anti-Vietnam protesters. Eventually, about 700 police or more burrowed their way in through tunnels and dragged them all out, and it was really heavy-handed, and it was really ugly. And about about 700 students were roughed up, arrested, brutalized. Now, the police did not want that to happen. They really felt that if they had got in all guns blazing, that it would have basically been fuel to the grist for the mill of students who have been accusing the police of heavy-handed tactics. So they went in through a window, they brought a crane, and they all went in. And very soon afterwards, they brought out students whose hands were tied behind their backs with those plastic ties. They were arrested. They were loaded on buses. There was no shouting. A couple of the students who gathered yelled, "Shame on you," at the police. But by and large, it was a really peaceful, well-executed operation, because the students do not have the right to occupy buildings. That is not a right that they have. They have the right to protest. But what they were doing was actually, it's a pretty low ranking, you know, misdemeanor or felony, but it was a crime. Mm. So, you know, the police, the college at that point were within their rights to call the police. Now, what happened in Texas at the University of Austin, which of course we have Greg Abbott, the governor down there, who's all about strong arm tactics, whether it's immigrants, whether it's students, whether it's anybody who doesn't slot into his far right silo. He sent the police into the campus with pepper spray. They roughed up students. They charged them with horses. They dragged them onto the streets. And it was really pretty horrific. At USC, the students said the police were really heavy handed as well. I don't think it was on the same level from speaking to them as it was at University of Austin, where it really seems that the police went way beyond what was necessary on the direct instructions of the governor. So no, the other states like New York, California, they don't want to see that kind of activity. They don't want to see that kind of police brutality. They don't want to see violent clashes between the police and the students, particularly if students are peacefully exercising their rights to protest. So long answer, Jarlett, sorry.
That's okay.
But it's a complicated
situation. And, you know, since April 18th, more than 1,000 people have been arrested and more than 25 campuses. Yeah. So what's to stop it from happening again? Are we just going to see a cycle until a ceasefire occurs or some kind of significant change occurs?
Well, you know, what will stop it to some degree is that the college term is now about to be over. The reason that the protests and the occupations did ratchet up to a degree was partly strategic. And you have to applaud the students for their strategy. And as I said, this is over the next couple of weeks, it's all the graduations, it's the commencement speeches, it's when they invite really distinguished guests to give commencement speeches, and the eyes of the media, you know, depending on who the guest is, and the eyes of the parents and the eyes of the donors are all over the colleges. So clearly, if you've got the lawns where the graduation speeches are planned to take place covered in tents, you know, in encampments by protesters, if you have it so that also a lot of classes were cancelled and students were asked to take online classes for safety as well. So there has been a disruptive element there. But by and large, most classes are over by now. They're winding down. And I think the students feel that if they want to get attention, this is their best opportunity now, because the colleges, as I said, these colleges like Columbia, $90,000 a year for fees. The parents want to come and see their kids graduate. They don't want to be stepping over tents, and they don't want to be running the gauntlet of protesters to do so. So I think that it was felt that this was the maximum leverage that these protesters could operate. And, you know, so what will probably happen is, as soon as the colleges are empty, as soon as they're closed for the summer, as soon as the term is over and the graduations have been done, there will be no reason to occupy the campuses because they'll be empty. So I think that some of the more sage staffers and faculty members feel that this problem will take care of itself without having to trample the students' rights. But, you know, again, there are so many things. There are safety concerns. There's the right of students who are not taking part in these protests to be able to study, to be able to attend their lectures. There's the right of Jewish students on campus not to feel intimidated and threatened by people who are using these protests as a pretext for their own anti-Semitism. And there's also the absolute right of the pro-Palestinian students to be able to make their voices heard without being denigrated, without being accused of being anti-Semitic, and without being harassed and bullied.
Well, on to a less serious story, but one that has occupied more airtime than I can even believe. You may remember Mitt Romney infamously tied a dog in a kennel to the roof of his car for a cross-country trip. But at least he didn't shoot it. I mean, that's what Kirsty Noem has admitted to doing. Not like when you admit something, people are putting you under pressure to admit it. She volunteered this story in her upcoming memoir. I'm not sure what the name of that memoir is, Marion, you'll probably know, but it is the strangest twist in the hunt for a Donald Trump running mate that I could have expected. The double down on shooting this dog might be even stranger.
Well, you know, it's so bizarre that this is a horrible story. But as you say, it's so bizarre that you almost want to go, Jesus, like that. So you're absolutely right. Her memoir, which the Guardian newspaper got excerpts from, and you can imagine their glee. It's like, you know,
jackpot.
Holy Jesus! Look what we've got, a live one here. Yeah. So in this, she's basically talking about. I remember, okay, let me preface this with a story about Kirsty Noem, to put it in context. And I think we may have chatted about this before on the podcast, Charlotte.
Yeah.
When I was at CPAC and at an event afterwards, Kirsty Noem, who the MAGA people love, they absolutely love her. I can't tell you how much they love her. You know, she looks MAGA. She looks like she could be any of Trump's wives or girlfriends or whatever. They all have that look, the fillers, the long wavy hair, the bodycon dresses. And she's been a very feisty, tough governor in South Dakota. For one of her claims to fame, if you can call it that, is that she allowed the single biggest super spreader, COVID super spreader in America in the entire 3 years of COVID to take place in South Dakota. Every year they have the biker rally in Sturgis, a town in South Dakota. About 250,000 Hells Angels and various other people turn up into this tiny little town. I've been there when it happened. It is, you're crammed in. It's crazy. The streets are packed. People are falling out of bars with pints in their hands. It's nuts. Anyway, as super spreader events go, they don't come any more effective. So she allowed this event, 250,000 people, to take place in Sturgis in South Dakota. COVID ran around it like wildfire. And then, of course, they all went home to their own states and their own towns or whatever and brought it with them. So, you know, that, and she has still boasted about that, how she will not and would not shut down South Dakota. So anyway, I digress there. The story I was going to tell you about was when she was 10 years old. Okay, picture the scene. She's living in the wilds of South Dakota in a ranch, and her dad tells her he's going to take her for an overnight camping trip to the mountains about 30 miles away to some sort of very rocky, rugged area, which, you know, is very far from human civilization.
Right.
So anyway, they start out, herself and her dad, and they're both on their horses, and she's on her little pony, age 10, and the dad says, it's dark. I think she said it was about 9 o'clock at night. He said, oh, I've got to go back. I forgot something. You better just go on ahead to the camp. Just go over that mountain 10 miles and down the other side and you'll find it. So she believes she's been abandoned in the dark, in the wilderness, on her own by her dad, and she decides the only thing to do is to keep going. So meanwhile, you know, people's faces were going, Jesus Christ, even these MAGA macho people. And then she said, well, look, it wasn't that bad because when I got back the next day, so she was left to spend what she believed was a night on her own in the wilderness. You can imagine how terrified she must have been. So she said when she got back home the next day, her mom said to her, oh, you know, your dad actually followed you secretly and kept an eye so that nothing would happen. But her dad, while he was secretly following her, kept making terrifying bear sounds to scare her even more. You know, I mean, it's like,
Christ.
So this is Kirsty Noem's background.
Up. Yeah.
And you can see how this bizarre situation where she thought it was a badge of honor almost that she did this, that the dog, that Cricket wouldn't play ball, that she took Cricket out on a pheasant hunt and Cricket was having too good a time. And I think her words in the memoir, if the quote is accurate, is that as she watched him chasing birds, having the time of his life, you know, whatever, she knew then he had to die. and so she took him back to her farm, took him to a gravel pit and shot him dead. This was a 14-month-old dog who she said she couldn't train, that he'd bitten her once, that he was, you know, untrainable, basically. And while
she wasn't
was
10
pit,
years old at the time, though. It wasn't. This wasn't in the same time window, was it? She wasn't 10 at the time.
No. This is recent.
This is grown-ass Kirsty Noem.
This
right.
is But this is a grown woman making this decision. And also then, while she was in the gravel pit with the dog and the gun, she decided she'd shoot a goat as well on the basis that the goat was smelly.
While I'm here.
While I'm at it, you know. And then, but she then didn't shoot the goat properly. And she had to go and get another. She left the goat basically dying while she went off and got another shell to you know, to go and shoot him. And so many things wrong with this. A, the unnecessary cruelty, the brutality, and B, that if you're this outdoors person, what are you doing with only two bullets in your gun anyway? You know, I mean, it's,
yes.
So anyway,
I mean,
there was a huge pushback.
Yeah. So yeah, talk me through the pushback on this, because obviously most people are revulsed by this and just think that's that, right? That's the end of her. Not everyone, obviously.
Well, you know what? Her defense for herself was basically that Americans want leaders who are authentic. So, you know, if you do something like this, well, tell people if they don't like it, tough luck. But also her other defense was that, oh, well, you know, you people who are upset about this, you don't even understand farm life and ranch life. And just the other day, we had to shoot three horses. It's like, Jesus Christ, quit while you're ahead. Stop digging that hole.
Yeah, stop volunteering information of your killings. But Marion, I did think that there were, like, I'm in the countryside here where I live in Ireland, and I'm well aware of, you know, farm life, and, you know, there's a line with dogs and cats that, you know, they're above kind of work animals and those that are being employed, that, you know, this dog,
family members.
Yeah.
You know,
and this dog wasn't, he's also, you know, he's not done learning. Untrainable.
He's still a pup. At 14 months.
But bizarrely, I wondered, and I want to put this to you, is it possible that we've been catfished here and that this was an attempt, one, by her to paint herself as the no bullshit VP, you know, I'll get it done, and present herself as hardline. Two, what a wonderful distraction from this Trump trial. Already, she's got his back.
You know what? I think both of those things can be partly true, but I don't think it worked. I think she absolutely believed, because, you know, I've seen her giving speeches and I've seen her on stage, and she does this sassy, no-nonsense rodeo queen, country girl, grew up on a ranch. You know, you look at me crooked and I'll show you who's boss. Like, you know, that's her whole persona. And as I said, the MAGA crowd eat it up. Apart from Matt Gaetz, to me, she's the only other person, and Trump, of course, who really seems to have fire up the MAGA crowd, that they just love her. And they love that persona of her, that she's this tough as nails, you know, fearless, whatever. And I think she really believed that this anecdote was serving that image, that it would only burnish that image further. But what she didn't realize, I think, outside of and even inside the MAGA crowd, is, as we said, most people in America regard their dogs as members of their family, as their pets.
Yeah.
And the idea that you would shoot a dog, from a puppy, for misbehaving because he's not properly trained, it's just like, oh my God, like you said, it's like Mitt Romney putting the dog in the car. People spoke about that. They're still talking about that, for God's sake. You know, so I think she completely miscalculated. And I think that, to a degree, she has distracted from the Trump trial in New York, but not enough. You know, not so much that it's not being commented on, that he's falling asleep, that he's attacking his lawyer, that he's grouchy.
Hold it all, Marion, hold it all. We're going to talk about all of that over on patreon.com/Irishmanabroad. Lads, you're missing out on the best bit of the show. Marion's rolling. We're into the good stuff now. Couple of clicks, you're a member, and I promise you, 2024 is going to be the year you need to be a member of Irishman Abroad. I have so many exciting things lined up for you and the members in the year to come. You're going to look back on this moment and go, why didn't I do it then? Irishman Abroad over on Patreon, just search that, couple of clicks, you're in. You're going to want to hear Marion's take on the Trump trial this week and lots more.
Ready? You have the cameras rolling?
This is America.
A lot of people who would probably consider themselves liberal have done very well financially under the Donald Trump 4 years.
You encouraged
espionage against our people.
Do you condemn any interference by Russia in the American election?
By Russia or anybody else?
Russia, please, if you can, get us Hillary Clinton's emails. Please, Russia, please.
To renew America, we must revitalize our democracy.